In Matthew's Gospel, in chapter 20, Jesus told a parable, reveals a very shocking truth. Here's what he said. A landowner with a great vineyard went out early in the morning to find workers for the vineyard. He found some and he offered to pay them a fair wage for a day's work. At 9 in the morning, he went out, found more, and gave them the same offer. They accepted. He did the same thing at noon, 3, and then again at 5 p.m. Evening came, and it was time for the landowner to pay up. The workers would get what was fair and just. They would get what they earned, or so they thought. Now, if you're hearing this story for the first time, and I hope some of you are, what are you expecting to happen? Who do you think the landowner represents in this story? Well, it represents God, the Father. And knowing what you do about God, what sort of payment do you expect him to give? Well, God's generous. You would expect him to give a slightly higher than average wage, probably. He's not stingy. But more than that, you would expect him to get a fair wage, or to give a fair wage. God must be fair. He doesn't give preferential treatment. He must give what is right according to what is earned and what is deserved. So, when payroll is due, we expect the landowner, we expect God, to give the most money to the workers who worked the longest day, followed by those who worked from 9 a.m., a bit less to those who worked at noon, even less to those who worked at 3, and only a very small portion to those who barely put in an hour's worth of work. This is fairness, right? This is justice. And if he's anything, he's a God of justice. But the landowner, to the shock and to the dismay of all the workers, gives the same wage to all of them, regardless of their start time. And you know what happened? Protest. Vehement protests. This is unjust. It isn't fair. And the boss responds by saying, "Why are you so envious? Because I am gracious." Take note. Take note that the workers are not happy that the boss has gone way beyond fairness, which is just giving the wage that's earned, and instead has been extravagantly gracious. The landowner's grace is not being celebrated. It's as if he completely ignored their own work. He's ignored what they earned or didn't earn, and he's giving them what he decided to give, which for all of them was more than they deserved. All of them. Remember, the landowner is the one who sought them out. The landowner owns the land. The landowner had the vineyard. The landowner invited them in. They didn't submit an application for work. He asked them, "Why aren't you working?" They said, "No one's hired us." So they were lost. They didn't have a hope of income. And the landowner just showing up that day, just showing up, was more than they deserved or had earned. Nevertheless, they conveniently ignored that fact and cried out for justice when the salaries were being distributed. How many have heard that story before? A handful. Most of them. Those of us who have heard the story before, does it bother you? No, probably not much. We think, man, God is cool. That's straight up awesome for him to give a lot to the 5 o'clock guys like he did to the 6 a.m. people. That's pretty cool. But would we really be happy about that arrangement? Everyone, no matter how long you've worked, or your qualifications, or your seniority, or your job level, gets the same amount. What do we call that? Some might call it communism. Now are we adequately offended? I say we. Remember, this is not my parable. I'm telling you this story from Jesus. Get mad at him. Don't get mad at me. I think the parable does a lot of things, teaches us a lot of things. But one of the things that I'd like to suggest is in our deepest being, we resist grace. We are wired to earn our way and to get what we deserve. And Jesus reveals the God that doesn't work on our fairness model. He's extravagantly gracious to everyone. What if, at the end of the day, when that great day of final accounting, that great day of judgment, when the culmination of the world takes place and it finally arrives, and it will arrive one day, we say it every single Sunday in the Creed. What if we encounter a God who can't wait to be gracious to us instead of doling out punishment? What if that's the God we encounter? And then you start to think about the people around you that don't deserve any of that grace. Ah, what will it be like for us to stand and to see all of those people receive grace and kindness, the same that we get? Some of us grew up in a church environment that probably inadvertently, but nevertheless definitely, portrayed God as mostly angry with us. He sees what you're doing in secret. He knows your heart. He's aware of where your eyes roam and how your thoughts wander. These were terrifying statements to me when I was a kid. Now, it might be true that God sees all of that, but they were used in such a way to get me to conform to rules, subtly teaching me that as long as I obeyed the rules, as long as I fell in line, that this angry God wasn't going to zap me. Now, I knew, even back then, that God gives grace, but I was under the strong impression he gives it only to the ones who met certain qualifications. He's gracious to those who've earned enough, the ones who've prayed enough, who've served enough, who've read their Bible enough, who've gone to church enough, who have given their tithe enough. That one might be true. I don't know. And we never know what enough is. But it was always just a bit more than what you think. A number of years ago, a young man, high school student, one of my son's friends, he won his basketball game. We were attending the game. He won the game. And he saw me afterwards and he said, "Hey, you know why we won, right?" I said, "Why?" He said, "Because I was at church on Sunday." This is a high school kid. It's hilarious. He said, "It's been ages since I've been to church, and I went this past Sunday, so that must be why we won." And he said, "It seems to me that every time I go to church, we win." And so I asked him, "Then why aren't you in church every Sunday, you knucklehead?" And then I said, "I hate to say it, but it doesn't work that way. God doesn't dole out grace to those who earn it. He doesn't give grace to the ones who deserve it. If he did, well, it wouldn't be grace. Grace, by its very definition, is something that can't be earned. It's a free gift on the part of the giver. Free in the sense that the giver isn't compelled in any way to give it other than out of the giver's own great love for the other. God doesn't owe us anything, especially grace. But he gives it extravagantly. Now, I wonder if that's the impression you have of God. Extravagant, gracious God. Maybe you do when times are good. Maybe you don't when times are not. We struggle with this idea of an extravagantly gracious God, because a lot of people think that if it's worth having, it's worth paying for. If we're going to prefer it, and furthermore, if we're going to experience that extravagant grace, then we must come to grips with at least three realities, and we can find them in our text in Hebrews for today. Number one, we need it. Number two, only Jesus can really give us what we need. Only Jesus. And number three, we must boldly ask for it. So first, we need it. Now, young people, this isn't what you learn from your culture. Instead, you hear, you can do anything you choose to do. You can be independent. You are a self-made person. You don't need anybody else. You get all the toxic people out of your life. It's just you, 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 you. You don't need to be dependent on anyone. Movies communicate a clear message that we are gods unto ourselves. But for all our self-congratulating, we still know, deep down, if we're honest, that we need help, right? We aren't God. We need help with our bodies, with our children, with our finances, with our hurts, our depression, our anxieties. We need help with our relationships, with our habits, with our minds. We are, by our very nature, dependent. And that means we need help from outside of ourselves. We also know that we have this other problem. In the church, we call it sin. And so we don't deserve any of the help that we need and that we get. Sometimes we desperately need grace and help, but we know we don't deserve it, and so we feel trapped and we feel stuck. Because we think we have to earn our way first in order to get that grace, and so it's this vicious cycle that we find ourselves in. And maybe you felt that before. Maybe you feel it now. I suppose we can respond to this trap or cycle in several ways. We could put on a mask and pretend that all of these hurts and all the pain and the anger and the desperate financial situation and the addiction and all of those problems that we have, it's not really a big deal. We could do that. We could continue telling everyone fine when they ask us how we are. Like we do in here every Sunday, and like you do when people ask you during the week. And maybe we know it's not okay. Or maybe we've told ourselves for so long that we've just got this thing that now we can't even see just how much help we need. It's just sort of a part of us that's always there. Either way, we're desperate for grace, and instead of giving it, we put on a mask. Do you think that could happen to us, even Christians? Yeah, I think so. Sometimes the most liberating moment for men is the day that they take the mask off and get honest about that sexual addiction and admit they need help. Sometimes the most liberating day for others, for women, will be when you admit that you don't even know how to release those grudges that you're holding. And you need help. You need grace to forgive. One of the great life discoveries for young people is when they realize that their parents are flawed. And their parenting is flawed. And often the response to them is, I can't believe they raised me that way. And maybe that's what you're feeling right now. Maybe you have those thoughts. Maybe you're still at home and you have those thoughts. Maybe you're out of the house and you still have those thoughts. and you're starting to get angry and hold it against them. And the most liberating day for you will be the day that you can admit that you're angry with your parents and you can't forgive them on your own. So we need help, right? We need it, and we're sinners, and we feel trapped. Second, only Jesus can give us what we need. The writer of Hebrews is stating the case this way: how will you and I receive grace and help? And what's the writer's answer? This is church people. There are only two possible answers: Jesus or the Bible. Which one is it in this case? It's Jesus. I've already given you the outline. I told you in advance what the second point was. And then I said second, and the answer is Jesus. Okay. But here's the deeper thought. Why is Jesus, this particular man, Jesus of Nazareth, the one who lived 2,000 years ago, this male Jew, why is he the one, the only one that's qualified to give us this grace? And here's what the writer of Hebrews says. He is a human being who has overcome all of the tests, all of the obstacles, all of the traps that catch us, that have caught us from the beginning. He has overcome. He never sinned. He completely obeyed God's word. He submitted to death. Death, our ultimate enemy, that ultimate obstacle that none of us can escape. And he beat that enemy. And so the human that gets the victory is the only one who can now give the victory to others. And he's got that power. He's got that power over sin. He's the one who overcame temptation. And now he can give that power to you and to me as well to overcome temptation. He's the one who resisted greed by giving up the desire for earthly possessions. He didn't take revenge when he was falsely accused, but instead he forgave and prayed for his enemies. He didn't lose heart or belief in the Father when his cousin John the Baptist was murdered. He didn't lust when Mary washed his feet. He didn't dishonor his parents, even when they didn't understand him at 12 years old. And since he never sinned, he is now the source of grace for us, so that we too can beat sin. Jesus and Jesus alone is the source of victorious Christian living. And the writer of Hebrews says something a little bit deeper than that, too. He just goes farther and farther. He's the one who got the victory. He lived the perfect life. He died the death. He overcame all of that stuff that entraps us. Now he gives us the victory, and then he says this. He goes deeper than that. He empathizes with you. He understands where you are. He knows you are but dust. His heart goes out to your predicament. Yeah, but does he? Really? I mean, if he never gave in to temptation, does he really understand my struggle? I don't know that he does. C.S. Lewis answered that objection. I put it in the quote in the front of your bulletin there. I'll read it again for you. A silly idea is current that good people do not know what temptation means. This is an obvious lie. Only those who try to resist temptation know how strong it is. A man who gives in to temptation after 5 minutes simply does not know what it had been like an hour later. That is why bad people, in one sense, know very little about badness. I love that. That's one of my favorite lines in all of literature. They have lived a sheltered life by always giving in. They've lived the sheltered life. See how he flips it? They tell us we live the sheltered life because we haven't experienced all their badness. Lewis says it's exactly the opposite. They have lived a sheltered life by always giving in. Christ, because he was the only man who never yielded to temptation, is also the only man who knows to the full what temptation means. The only complete realist. He knows your struggle. He knows it better than you do. Because he resisted it for a very long time and successfully. He's walked that road. His heart is with us. And more than anything else, he wants us to be free from the weight of that pain and struggle and sin. See, all of that work on his part so that he can be extravagant in his grace giving. Third, we must confidently ask for his grace. Now, there's a very important distinction in the Christian life that we must understand, and our text for today in the book of Hebrews captures it perfectly. Here it is. God's goal for us is grace, unearned, completely free, extravagant, surprising, for anyone and everyone. That's God's goal. But it's not without some effort on our part. Now, here's the distinction. Effort isn't the same as earning. Faith and obedience and following Jesus take a lot of effort. Ask anyone in this room who's been following him for any amount of time. It's a life orientation that requires the discipline of prayer and resisting temptation and talking back to the cultural voices and listening to Jesus' voice in a deep and consistent way. It's running to Jesus with open hands in a faith response to what he's done for us. And our effort isn't a busyness to earn our way to God or to make sure that God owes us something, like that high school young person. We won the game because I showed up at church. It's not that. Our effort is a race to Jesus, the high priest, who gives us the life of grace that we all want, that we all need, and he loves to give it extravagantly. So Christianity is not sit back and wait for something nice to happen. And when things go wrong, God's giving us a raw deal. Christianity is an ongoing discipline, an effort, a lifestyle of following after Jesus that takes a lot of work. You may have caught it in my opening prayer, our invocation, where I talked about our work of worship. That's what the word liturgy means in the New Testament, the liturgos. It is our work, the people's work. So when we come to worship, we are doing that work that is a pattern for that life work that we have during the week. That's why we have this order. That's why we have these elements, because we're forming ourselves and training ourselves to do this same kind of work in a weekly pattern, in a daily pattern. And that effort is very real. And the writer of Hebrews talks about that on a regular basis, not just in chapter 4:14 that we read. He's regularly reminding his readers, don't stop, don't quit. Keep following after Jesus. Keep assembling yourselves together, Hebrews 10. On and on and on. Don't give up. I love how Eugene Peterson phrases verse 16 in our text, in the Message. He said, so let's walk right up to him and get what he is so ready to give. Take the mercy. Accept the help. Strange turn of phrase, isn't it? Because we think, well, sure, accept the help. But remember, we tend to resist grace. Why wouldn't we accept that help? Why wouldn't we do that today? Maybe you've done that before. But maybe not. Maybe you really don't know what it means to follow Jesus during the week. I mean, everyone that's in this room right now, we're regular attendees. You're here on a Sunday. But maybe the week looks different for you. I don't know. Maybe you struggle to understand what it means to have freedom from guilt. Freedom from sin. To experience the joy of receiving grace from the God who made you and made everything that we see. Maybe you prayed a prayer a long time ago. You made a commitment at some point to Christ. But now church and faith are a little bit monotonous, tedious, uninteresting. More of a burden than anything else. A friend of mine told me about one of his friends who, no matter where he is on his business travels, will find an AA meeting to attend. Here's an interesting thing. This guy's been sober for 25 years. And every week, he finds an AA meeting. You know why? It takes a lot of effort to stay sober. Regular. Devoted, faithful effort. Not earning it, but effort. Some of us came to Jesus a long time ago, but for one reason or another, we stopped running the daily race toward Jesus. And we wonder why. Why our hearts are unsettled and our minds are lost in darkness. And maybe the tentacles of anger and lust and loneliness have wrapped around our hearts and are squeezing Jesus and grace right out. And that can happen. That can happen to Christians who've been around the church for a long time. That can happen to us. It can happen to me. And there's a better way. Jesus is the source of our power over that sinful struggle. And all he says, this is what the writer of Hebrews says. He says, come and do it boldly. And ask. Come to the throne of grace. And Jesus loves to give that grace extravagantly. And that's our invitation. It's our invitation to you and to me. Thanks be to God.